Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Zurich, Switzerland, in New York, and earned a bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of California, Berkeley. After 9 years as a jet attack aviator in the U.S. Marine Corps, he began his legendary 48-year career in the automotive industry. He's held senior leadership positions with GM, Ford, Chrysler, and BMW. He's arguably the most influential automotive executive of the last 50 years. His name, Bob Lutz. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to the ultimate car guy, Bob Lutz. Bob, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, good to be with you, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I was born in Zurich, Switzerland, to two Swiss parents. But my maternal grandmother was English and my paternal grandmother was French. So I suppose I could say I'm one quarter French, one quarter British, and 50% Swiss, but a naturalized American citizen. My dad was a banker at Credit Suisse. He was with Credit Suisse his whole career. Spent the first, early youth in Switzerland. Then we moved to the States in 1939, and we were in the States from 39 through 47, which is when I learned English and basically became culturally American. But I had, I had a very secure, safe, and I wouldn't say overly affluent, but certainly a very comfortable childhood. And I'm not one of these people who can claim to have risen from poverty, because I did have a privileged youth where everything was paid for and was sent to the good schools and so forth.
Where did you get your love for flying?
Well, that started very early. I think from the time I was a toddler being put in the bathtub by my mother, I'd have, ship models around me. Always had airplanes that I was roaring around with and cars. So I was always very vehicle-oriented. Somehow the ship part kind of faded into the background, but cars became a dominant force in my life from the time I was at about three. And then, when World War II arrived, the car culture was kind of put aside because we didn't produce cars from 1941 until 1946. So there was a five-year gap of no new models. Whereas on the airplane front, a fighter aircraft of the world essentially supplanted the car hobby, because everybody was constantly introducing new fighter aircraft, new versions, upgraded engines, more weapons, more armament, and it was like at a cadence of every few months. It's not like today when the F-15 air superiority fighter came out in 1975 and it's still America's frontline fighter, or the F-16s that are almost 40 years old now. Back in those days, when we were competing with the Germans and Japanese, it was just like every couple of months somebody was introducing some hot new fighter. And it was obviously very fascinating. And I very much wanted to, this is stupid, but it's one of these stupid things you think when you're a kid. I was hoping World War II would last long enough to where I could be a fighter pilot.
For 11 years, 54 to 65, you were a jet attack aviator in the Marine Corps. What's the biggest thing you learned in the Marine Corps?
Well, the Marine Corps teaches you a set of values. It also teaches you the reliance, the fact that it teaches you teamwork. the fact that it teaches you that you must be an absolutely reliable member of the team, just as you can absolutely rely on the Marine next to you. And that's a bond that's formed through a good selection process, and then also a very, very rigorous basic training program that's very tough. It's tough physically, it's tough psychologically, but if you will, it's a sort of a filter through which not everybody passes, but the ones that do pass are your fellow Marines, and you know you can rely on them for the rest of your life. So this feeling of being part of a worthy elite where nobody was able to bypass the system, nobody was able to cheat their way in, you know that you can rely on your fellow Marines. And this feeling of belonging to an elite organization and the value that that brings, I think, is something that every Marine carries with him or her for the rest of their lives.
In 63... you join General Motors, and you start this unbelievable 48-year career. And here's a quote from you. "The automobile is still the most emotional product on the market today." Bob Lutz, how do you explain the allure, the magic of cars?
Well, it's this way, Jack. Your household appliances, you know, your refrigerator, your washer, dryer, and stove, those are genuinely appliances because you use those in the sanctity and privacy of your own home. And you're never worried. You don't take your refrigerator for walks to where you risk people saying, "Ugh, look at that guy. He's using a 30-year-old, broken-down, shabby, dirty old refrigerator, and it's the wrong brand." Whereas the automobile, you are seen in it. It becomes like, I always say, it's like an exoskeleton. It's like a second body that you wrap around you. People select cars that they feel reflect favorably on their choices or their personality or their taste or their station in life, which really goes a long way to explain the success of brands like Mercedes-Benz and BMW and Audi and Jaguar, which, you know, seen functionally, they're really no better than cars costing half the price. But people buy them because of all of the associations with that, with the name, and because of what they think ownership of that brand says about them. So the automobile choice or automobile purchase is intimately linked with who we think we are or who we would like to be. And that's why there is such enormous psychological and sociological content to automobiles, more than to houses, in fact.
We're talking to Bob Lutz, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with arguably the most influential automotive executive of the last 50 years, Bob Lutz. Bob, from 63 to 71, you're with GM, 71 to 74, BMW, 74 to 86, Ford. Then after all those great years at Ford, you join Chrysler in 86. And you write a book, Guts, The Seven Laws of Business That Made Chrysler the World's Hottest Car Company. Chrysler was on its deathbed. How did you guys turn it around?
Well, you know, the first time it was turned around by Lee Iacocca, that this was in the 79, 80, 81 period when Chrysler needed the federal loan guarantees. But then we ran into very stiff headwinds again in 88, 89, 90. As we had another recession and industry sales declined a lot. And for that one, I would say Lee Iacocca was not as influential. But he turned it over to a team with, especially the team in product development, manufacturing, and so forth, which I was privileged to lead. And I would say the way we turned it around was exactly the same way that the General Motors recovery took place, which is stop messing around with financial engineering and just focus on doing world-class products that people that are beautifully styled, are mechanically as good as you can get them, and will make people want to buy them. And if you focus on that, you know, the money takes care of your of itself. It's really odd how, to me, how few people in the car business, that was the subject of my book, Car Guys versus Bean Counters, they think you can sort of financially optimize the creation of a new car. You know, don't spend too much, don't put too much money in it, don't make it too good because people can't tell the difference. And then they hope to make a lot of money on it, and it's just so wrong. You have to put the quality in, the features in, the styling in, the beautiful paint, the beautiful interiors, and if you do that, the money will follow. At any rate, we focused on the product at Chrysler, and we also got rid of most of the sticky, slow-moving, lethargic bureaucracy that does a lot of business with itself and produces very little customer benefit. And there were five or six of us who basically knew the business very well. And the five or six of us basically did the product plan. We did the long-range plan. We decided what was going to be done when. And we basically cut out most of the huge bureaucratic churning that tends to slow automobile companies down. So we produced a lot of great new cars and trucks in a very short time. And for a while there, Chrysler's market share went from a little bit under 10% in the U.S. To about 15 or 16%. So it was a formula that really worked.
If you want to learn more about Bob's books, etc., www.boblutz.com. From 98 to 2001, Bob, CEO of Exide. Then, at age 69, in August of 2001, Rick Wagner calls you, hires you at GM as vice chairman and product czar. Talk about those 9 years at GM.
Well, it was, in a way, it was one of the most rewarding assignments of my life because I was sort of in extra innings, if you will, since by the time I really started at GM, I was a full 70 years old. So I had nothing left to prove, and I came with a good reputation. I came in a position where I had a lot of rank and a lot of horsepower. I had the full backing of Rick Wagner. And, you know, I quickly did an assessment of where GM was, and it was General Motors was brilliant at manufacturing. General Motors was just not brilliant at creating the kinds of cars that people actually wanted to buy. And it was this whole Harvard Business School financial optimization approach to where it wasn't the engineers and the designers that were defining the next generation of cars. It was product planners and finance people who would then over-define the car and then turn it over to the designers. And it was this huge bureaucratic apparatus that was supposed to run like a computer and produce optimized cars. There was very little senior management involvement. Rick Wagner one day asked me, Bob, what do you think is our single largest problem with our cars? And I said, Rick, the single largest problem is the interiors. Our interiors are terrible. And Rick looked at me and he said, well, what's wrong with them? I said, Rick, have you been in competitors' cars? Have you sat in a Volkswagen or an Audi? Have you sat in a Lexus or even a Toyota or a Honda Accord and see what kind of materials they use on the inside and how everything fits? Well, he hadn't, and nobody else in senior management had either. So all of senior management was very, very distant from the product, and it was delegated to lower-level people who were supposed to really know what they were doing. Well, you know, if in a finance-dominated system where cost is everything, The people that you're relying on to do a good job will obviously follow the path of least resistance, and that's don't argue about the cost, just do it the way they say. And that resulted in mostly mediocre products that General Motors wasn't making any money on. But the big exception is trucks. In all three American car companies, trucks have always been off to the side, run by better people, left alone by senior management, not run by committee, and a fierce competitive battle among the big three for who has the best trucks. So trucks, I always set aside. Nobody in the world builds a pickup truck or a full-size sport utility like the American firms. But anyway, General Motors was caught in this bean counter system where there was no passion for the product. It didn't matter whether we could have just as well been producing cans of baked beans. It just didn't matter to anybody. That was the thing I was able to reverse. I was able to get the company refocused on product excellence. I was able to define product excellence for them. I re-empowered the designers to where the designers, instead of being also RANs, they became almost the driving force in product development. And it not only worked, but I see that it's continuing.
When we come back, we'll ask Bob Lutz about his latest, newest book, Icons and Idiots, Straight Talk on Leadership. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Bob Lutz, whose latest book is entitled Icons and Idiots, Straight Talk on Leadership. Bob, you profile 11 men. You've met tens of thousands of leaders in your career, 11 men, and the first one you profile is a high school teacher, George Andre Chavales. Why?
That's right. He was one of the most remarkable men I've met in my life. He was a homeroom and French and French literature teacher down in the French part of Switzerland, and I was, of course, a German-speaking student. And he had this class of Swiss kids from the German-speaking part of Switzerland, and he was going to teach them French and French lit and so forth. He was an absolutely remarkable man, and I was in my late teens, or maybe I was 20. I finished high school very late, and I thought that I was just captivated by this guy. His sense of discipline, his command presence, his communication skills, his sense of logic, his knowledge of history, the fact that he was in his early 30s. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Swiss Army, which is an all-reserve force. And I just thought, how can a guy with these capabilities be... I mean, I was glad he was doing it, but I thought, this gentleman is capable of way more than being a high school teacher. Well, you know, a few years later, he was mayor of the city of Lausanne, and then... a little bit later, he was a member of the Swiss Parliament, and even later, he wound up being president of Switzerland. So my instincts were right. He was capable of being more than a high school teacher.
The second person you profile, Staff Sergeant Donald Giusto, what did he teach you?
Well, you know, he was your normal Marine drill instructor, although back in those days, I would say there was... much more physical abuse of recruits, which is now no longer tolerated, and I'm not sure we've advanced the cause by taking all the physical punishment out of Marine Corps recruit training, but it is what it is. But he taught, first of all, he taught absolute obedience, but then once you had the absolute obedience, he taught these team skills, he taught Marine Corps values, he obviously taught all of the practical stuff that you need to know as a Marine infantry person. And he also was a very dominant figure, very self-confident, apparently fearless, could stare down any recruit, no matter how large. So he became the personification for all recruits. I think their drill instructor becomes the personification of what the Marine Corps is trying to be, or what the Marine Corps wants you to be. So everybody kind of worships their drill instructor, and I think you ask anybody who's in the Marine Corps to name their drill instructor, and nobody will ever say, well, I can't quite remember the guy's name. I mean, everybody has vivid, colorful recollections of their drill instructor.
Another person you profile, Philip Caldwell, former chairman and CEO of Ford Motor Company, and you say you might not like him, but you've got to respect him.
Yeah, that's true. And Phil had a lot of idiosyncrasies. He was very, very cold. He never showed you his cards. He was always poker-faced. He had very little apparent sense of humor. He could be an unbelievably pedantic and pursue things down to minute detail that had absolutely no bearing on the success or failure of the project. But you had to give him credit that he did a good job. And I will say one thing, for all of the frustration working for him and for all of the ego trips that he went on, he did focus on two things. He said, Ford Motor Company is in deep financial trouble. We're going to have to try to reverse that, obviously. But we're going to focus on doing absolutely great cars. You know, there's that same message again, which was the first generation Taurus and Sable. And he said, and this was at a time when American quality, this was in the mid-'80s when early to mid-'80s when American quality had a reputation for being really, really bad, and in truth it was. And this was when the Japanese developed their reputation for quality superiority. Phil Caldwell says we're going to reverse that. And says from now on, the top priority of this company is impeccable quality and reliability. We are going to become the world's quality leaders. And so I think it's important for a senior leader to set some guidelines and to focus the organization on a goal. And the goal that he placed above all others, and he was willing to, you know, sacrifice other goals in order to enable this one goal that he set for himself, which was quality. Well, during his tenure, Ford never quite achieved world-class quality leadership levels, but at least it became clearly the best of the domestics, which was a major step forward. But there was nothing personable or likable about Phil Caldwell, and in fact, I don't think many people did like him, but there's no denying that you had to respect him for what he was and what he did.
The eighth person you profile, Lee Iacocca, chairman and CEO of Chrysler Corporation, and you say the name is an acronym for, quote, I am chairman of Chrysler Corporation always.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that one originated on Wall Street, and I got it from my dad.
Tell us about Iacocca.
Yeah. Well, Iacocca, most people know him as from television ads, you know, striding through factories while talking and convincing the American public to give Chrysler products a try, seemingly limitless self-confidence and so forth, totally in command of all situations at all times. And in fact, there was a partial reality to that, but there was also a very soft, insecure, somewhat nervous side to Lee Iacocca. And you saw that especially in social situations or business-related social situations where he was dealing with people that he didn't know. And he always seemed to be nervous and ill at ease, and he didn't say very much, and so forth. So there was also a lot of the bluster and a lot of the profanity and a lot of the tough talk that he was known for masked a certain shyness or timidity. And I think one of the things that bothered him is he really did come from that little town called Humble Origins, where, especially in the Ford Motor Company, he was dealing with the Ford family, phenomenally rich, well-educated, you know, to the manor born, partial Henry Ford II, partially educated in Europe, spoke French and so forth. Was always beautifully tailored, whereas Lee Iacocca grew up more in a working class environment, and I think he always felt a sense of social inferiority when he was around people like the Ford family, and that sometimes drove his behavior. When Iacocca was in good form, you told yourself, "Man, this is the most brilliant person alive. He can take complicated situations, make sense out of them, come up with a viable solution," and you were just in awe over this man's mental capability. And then he'd have other days where he'd have completely wacky ideas and absolutely wouldn't listen to reason. So he was never down the middle. He was either brilliant or way off the track on one side.
The last person you highlight, Rick Wagner. Superior intelligence and human qualities don't always win.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I always said Rick Wagner is the best CEO I ever worked for. And then people say, yeah, but look, the company went into Chapter 11 under him. And I say, yeah, I know. And Rick Wagner, if you will, was the complete opposite of some of the other leaders I've worked for in my life. Rick Wagner was extremely intelligent. I mean, possibly one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. Also very well educated, great background, great experience, wonderful personality, always behaved with absolute integrity, never lied, never shaded the truth, et cetera, et cetera. Had great respect for his subordinates, really trusted his people, looked out for his people, was downwardly loyal and so forth, showed no CEO disease. You know, he had no desire for luxurious trappings or big hotel suites or something, which most CEOs do get CEO disease at some point where they think only the best is barely good enough for him. Rick just always looked at himself as a hired hand, which, of course, is what all CEOs are. But he just looked at himself as a hired hand, and, you know, simple hotel room was fine for him. So in many, many ways displayed all of the qualities that you would put in an ideal CEO. What he didn't have, in my judgment, he didn't have enough. And you appreciate not getting it, but he was like a parent who is always nice to you. And what Rick lacked was the ability to be nasty, the ability to be arbitrary, the ability to be, say, look, we've discussed this enough. This is the second meeting we've discussed this. At this time, we're going to make a decision. And I know half of you are not going to be in agreement with the decision I'm making. Guess what? I'm making it anyway because we've got to move along. Well, you just never heard him talk that way because that wasn't his style. And what that did is it cost us valuable time. And we ultimately ran out of time. He also, by his innate sense of fairness and his lack of willingness to judge people negatively, he tolerated a lot of people in senior positions that I frankly would not have tolerated. And if you've got people in senior positions who are wielding a great deal of influence and controlling parts of the organization, and they're not very good, you know, that will cost you a lot of momentum. And he did tolerate them because these were people he had grown up with in General Motors. He'd known them his whole life. And I don't think he saw the fact that these people looked good, sounded good, but simply weren't delivering the goods.
We're talking to Bob Lutz, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasulo, and we're with the ultimate car guy, Bob Lutz. Bob, let's talk a little bit about leadership. Here's a quote from you. Most successful leaders are mentally and emotionally askew. There's a good side, which gets the job done. There's often also a downside that makes them hard to understand or difficult to work for. It's precisely because they are impatient, stubborn, opinionated, unsatisfied, and domineering that they're successful. Bob Lutz, why do you sugarcoat everything, please?
Well, that quote, I think we just talked about it in the Rick Wagner segment. Rick Wagner was that CEO that did not have this negative, arbitrary, impatient, sometimes wacky, sometimes unreasonable, sometimes nasty, look, I'm tired of talking about this, here's what we're going to do, which, of course, Iacocca was terrific at. So if the CEO, I think the ability to be a CEO or the ability to be a very strong leader almost means that the person has a very high degree of self-confidence, a high level of communication skills, and a very strong ability to convince others, and also to some extent a desire to dominate others. And, you know, that explains when it goes really bad, you have horrible dictators like Mussolini and Hitler and Stalin, who probably possessed unbelievably strong leadership skills, but on the other hand, were morally compromised and did a whole bit of damage. I don't think, you know, most leaders aren't that skewed, but I think most really successful leaders have this very strong side that permits them to lead effectively, but their personalities are balanced by some idiosyncrasies, like, as I was explaining, CEO disease, or the need for the need to constantly have people remind them of how great they are. Most of the very successful leaders I've met have had some really weird personal characteristics that definitely make them hard to work for. But so what? As long as they achieve the results for the shareholder.
In your book, Icons and Idiots, you profile 11 men, and you grade each of them on 10 traits, where you give them a grade from 1 to 5, and then you weight that from a 1 to a 10.
Yeah.
And there's only two 10s, weight-wise. One is results, and the other is integrity. What role does integrity play in leadership?
Well, integrity is the sine qua non. You know, you can have all the leadership skills in the world. You can have brilliant education. You can have a graduated from the top of your class in a famous business school. You can have a 147 IQ, et cetera, et cetera. And you can be skilled at leading people, convincing people, skilled at presenting the vision, getting people to follow, and so forth. But it all means nothing if the leader does not behave in an absolute integrity, high integrity fashion and demonstrate that integrity on a day-to-day basis. Because I'll tell you, a lack of integrity on the part, a lack of business integrity and personal integrity on the part of the senior leader's part creates a highly corrosive environment in the company. In that people always take their signals from the top leader. And if they see the top leader telling one story one time and a different version another time, and sort of lying to the media and kind of shading the truth when he or she speaks to the board of directors, people take their signals from that and they say, well, in this company, I guess it's okay to not be quite truthful and hide stuff and make things look better than they are and not surface the real situation, because that's certainly what the boss does. And I will, again, regardless of any other skills the leader may have, if integrity is not there, the company is doomed to failure. And we've seen a lot of companies lately, unfortunately. This is something you never saw in the 50s and 60s, but certainly from the 90s onward, we've seen a lot of CEOs lead the companies in a low-integrity way and ultimately destroying the company, destroying the culture, and in some cases, thankfully, winding up in jail themselves.
Bob Lutz, what is your proudest accomplishment in your 48-year iconic auto career?
Well, I think the thing I'm most proud of is being able to lead the cultural revolution at General Motors from 2001 to 2010, and getting the company focused on what General Motors was in the 60s, namely an absolute powerhouse at producing absolutely excellent, beautiful, well-made, high-quality cars and trucks, and reestablishing the faith in General Motors inside in the company that if we put in the quality and if we make the products desirable, the money will follow, as opposed to putting the money first and saying, here's the amount of money we want to make. Now let's build the cars just good enough to permit us to achieve that goal. So reversing that culture, and obviously I didn't do it myself. I had the support of Rick Wagner, and as is always the case when you come in as a new leader in a situation like that, you almost don't have to know what to do. You just have to be smart enough to listen to the right people, because General Motors was full of people at all levels who knew exactly what was wrong with the company and were very eager to tell me about it. It's just that they weren't being listened to. But I would say that this last assignment was my most satisfactory one.
Bob Lutz, what advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, the advice I would give, two pieces of one is, if you're not passionate about what you're doing, you're probably in the wrong field, and you should get out and do something that you are passionate about. You're always going to be better in something that you feel strongly about, a product or service that you personally love. Second thing is, always give it your best. Put your full energy in the job, and don't be a clock watcher or a calendar watcher. And the third bit of advice, and we just talked about it, is always behave with the highest integrity. If you don't have integrity, a lack of integrity, cheating, shaving, taking shortcuts will get you to a certain point, but then you'll be found out and you'll fail. Whatever it is you're doing, be passionate about it.
Bob Lutz, you've done that every day of your life. Thanks much. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.